Welcome to our session on App Compat, specifically designed for nerds. My name is Chris Jackson. I'm our worldwide lead for enterprise application compatibility on Windows, on IE, as well as on Office. That's a really long and incredibly painful thing to say, so I usually just say I'm the App Compat guy. My Twitter handle is @AppCompatGuy. I actually have a Twitter client open right now. That being said, we have a lot of slides to get through, so I'm just going to read them to you, okay? All right, we're done. On to the demos. As we talk about App Compat. And as we go through this, I'm going to kind of do it in a couple of different waves. All right, so this is designed for nerds. It's not designed for project managers, but we really need the nerds to talk some sense into the people who are running these projects. Right? So when we look at the things that are happening in the world of App Compat and some of the decisions that end up being made about the process, a lot of them don't make a great deal of mathematical sense. In fact, the actual approach that ends up being used assumes that the cost of failure is approximately equal to infinity. So therefore, we have to look at absolutely everything that there is and find out, make sure emphatically that it has no bugs, because of course, you don't have any bugs today. That's why you don't need a help desk. What we want to get to is a point where we get an analysis that says the cost of failure multiplied by the probability of failure is greater than the cost of my testing, right? So that if I have an application where if it goes down, it inconveniences a couple of guys for an hour, costing my business maybe $50, that I don't buy a $2,200 app testing service from someone who's selling that to me. Because that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yet people do that. We have this theory that says go find everything, test everything, and make sure that it all works. It's got to be tested thoroughly. You know who likes to tell you that message? The people who sell you per app services and products. They love for you to have that message. And we get into some pretty crazy things when we think about what is it that we would do per application. We like to do some debugging, so if you're holding out for the debugging, it's coming. But if we short-circuit a lot of this debugging, we end up doing much more of the actual good stuff. Let's think about some of the decisions that people make. So one of the things that comes up a lot is, I've got to get a thorough inventory of everything that I have so I can understand what's important. Then I'll rationalize it and get rid of the stuff that doesn't matter, right? Inventory, rationalize, and then do my testing, my remediation, and then I'm ready to go. That can kind of make sense for Windows apps, right? The largest Windows application inventory I've ever seen is 130,000 for 30,000 seats. I was pretty impressed with that too. When we look at other products, that gets bigger. The average number of Office documents that we see in the enterprise, in a large enterprise, 25 million. Because Office documents are pretty easy to make and throw up on file shares. The average number of unique URLs, aka web applications, that we see, numbers in the hundreds of millions in a typical enterprise. So let's take the middle one, Office. Find all of my Office documents and then tell me what's important as opposed to me just telling you. Right? If I just tell you, I'm going to have to go and get people making $300 an hour, have them spend a whole day, 8 hours, and get 100 of those guys to go through and tell me what matters. That's going to cost me $240,000. Let's write that down. 240,000 big ones. That's, you know, something I really want to avoid. So I'll just not bother them and take up that precious time. So instead, let's say, all right, let's find the 25 million applications. And we'll get a vendor to do it. They're going to charge me $100 an hour. And I'll have them spend 5 minutes looking at each application. And then they'll send me their bill for $125 million. So in order to avoid this $240,000 cost, I'm taking on a $125 million cost. That may not make sense. People aren't doing that math. Right? And if I say, you know what, the problem is you're charging too much. You are charging too much, so let me do the $25 million, and I'll have you charge, what's your minimum wage here per hour? Does anyone know? I assume you're all minimum wage workers, right? Just like me? All right, so let's say it's $10 an hour. I don't know, it's $5.25 in the U.S. So we'll say $5.25, we'll get cheap people, we'll poach them from McDonald's, and we'll have them spend 5 minutes each, which is actually 0.08 hours, not 0.05. And that's what we'll get. Oh no, it's still $10 million. And it turns out that in order to get it to cost the same, the only thing I have left to change, I can't change the number of documents, they've already been made. I can't go below minimum wage because the government won't allow me to, which means I got to decrease the amount of time I spend looking at so I have the people that I have scalped from McDonald's brought into my organization to rationalize get about 4.2 seconds per application to determine if it's business critical or not. How well do you think that's going to go over? That's the math we do. It doesn't make sense to get a comprehensive inventory when you have big numbers. And the law of large numbers is constantly fighting against us. Let's look at the AppCompat toolkit. How many of you have run the AppCompat toolkit and tried to gather some data from your existing desktops? A few folks, right? I had someone who said, here's what I want to do. I've got 100,000 desktops. I'm going to run this thing for 30 days. It uploads every 8 hours, so 3 times a day. And find out everything that's wrong. Right? So problem number one, you know what we look for in the AppCompat Toolkit 5.6? About a dozen things. So the correlation between whether we have an issue in ACT and whether or not you have one of those 12 things wrong with you is very high. The issue accuracy is fantastic. When it comes to the accuracy of whether the app as a whole works or not, turns out those 12 things aren't as predictive as we might like. In other words, we do about as well as chance. You could either run the toolkit or flip a coin and get roughly the same outcome. As a result, Act 6.0 does not have compatibility evaluators down level at all. They're gone because they waste your time. Right? But here's his plan. 9 million logs. It turns out those logs take about 17 seconds to process on 5.6, so we have this many seconds. I'm going to wait to get that data, which is that many minutes, which is that many hours, which is that many days, which is that many years, and it turns out that data might not be quite worth waiting 4.85 years to get your hands on. The law of large numbers is always working against you. So the approach that I'm always pushing for is to think about the apps that you have and think about how you're going to get them into a state of being managed. Because if you think about what it is that you're doing when you're guaranteeing compatibility, you're giving them an insurance policy. I am insuring your application against any changes in the environment. And what's happening is you have to then go and find out what you're insuring. If you don't know what apps you're on the hook to support, you've got to go discover them and then verify them. That's kind of a strange situation for an insurance agency, which you in essence are. That would be like me buying a house, having it burned down, having never purchased fire insurance, calling up the company and saying, I bought a house, you didn't detect it, it burned down, where's my money? That's what they're doing, right? They haven't given you a premium. You're making you guarantee something of unknown quality, right? A lot of times they just went to the store and bought it and installed it, and now you're on the hook to support it forever? Really? Instead, to get into a state where we look at different categories of applications, the applications that are managed. Managed applications I will promise to look at before I transition. In exchange, you're probably going to have to make sure I can afford to look at them instead of having that come out of my budget. You're going to also be responsible for telling me that they exist. We'll help you out the first time. We'll help you discover them. But you can't just buy stuff and expect me to stumble across it. The next category is one of supported applications. One that if you run into a problem and you call me, I'll work with you to get it fixed. But I'm not going to invest the money up front to make sure it works. This is a bit of a movable barrier because it depends upon how much stuff I anticipate to break. How many of you are still running XP on the majority of your desktops? Is that because you think XP is so awesome you're going to miss it? Is that because you're terrified your stuff's all going to break? Right? Certainly for IE6, I have never met anyone who says, oh, I really don't want to see IE6 go. That phrase has never been stated by anyone anywhere. Right? XP to anything Vista or later does have a tendency to break things, right? So the more stuff that breaks, remember our rule up front, right? The probability of failure, as that goes higher, I need to spend more time looking at stuff because I'm going to get an ROI from having looked at it and not having it fail. Versus, say, an Office 2003 to Office 2010, where the average failure rate is in the very low single-digit percentages. It doesn't save me a lot of money or hassle to look at a ton of stuff proactively because the risk of failure is pretty low. Same with the browser, right? The risk of failure and transition from IE8 to IE9, if you are leveraging the compatibility, and we'll talk about that when we get into the browser's part, the number of applications that I have worked with worldwide since the day we shipped IE9 that has not been fixable using the compatibility modes has been 4. Not 4%, but the number 4. Right? So the risk of failure is relatively low, assuming you've done some work up front. So this is a bit of a fuzzy barrier, but in essence, you're saying, managed, I'm going to make sure they work before I go. Supported, I'll start piloting, and you'll call me if there's a problem. And I'll help you out. A lot of stuff in the Office world goes through this supported category. Simply because, A, there's a ton of it, and B, when you look at, well, what's the outcome going to be if something fails, if you can say to yourself, you know what, I can wait half an hour if something goes wrong, supported might be a good category to be living in. You then get into unsupported, which means if someone calls you, you're going to say, you know what, that's not my problem. And some people even put in banned, right? That's what things like AppLocker are all about. You know, personally, I don't understand that. I work with a lot of companies where their guest networks will block your access to Facebook and Twitter. Number one, people are terrible at filtering their internet activity because just go to the SSL site and you usually get right through. Number two, what a strange thing to filter out. But there are some things that people don't want anyone using, period. So there is some banned stuff, right? AppLocker can be an assistant with that. But getting it in these different striations turns out to be really important for having a much more cost-effective transition. And it is up to the nerds of the world who can actually do math. This is multiplication and addition, and no one does it. And you end up doing really irrational things if you don't step back and take the time to make sure that your plan makes sense. You know, we look at it in all kinds of other ways. Let's leave that at that. I'm trusting you to starting applying some mathematical rigor to the things that we're doing. So let's talk now about the issues to come up. And I'm going to look at issues for both Windows as well as for Internet Explorer and the browser space, right? And take a look at the way we investigate both of those and the things you can proactively do with an eye on getting XP retired. So we'll talk about what's new and different in Windows 8, what the big challenges there are, as well as universal problems that apply for anyone coming from XP, which is much, much harder. The big problem we face with Windows 8, well, you heard Steven Sinofsky, if it works on Windows 7, it works on Windows 8. If you want to talk about the day my Twitter feed exploded, that was the day. Everyone's like, oh, really? Nothing will break? Yeah, well, until people stop looking at the version of things, things will break. Okay, we won't name these guys. Right? This is the kind of thing that still plagues us. I need to be greater than or equal to. It's as if people can't find the key on their keyboard that looks like that. Right? Here's a really terrifying statistic. We can actually look at some of the impact of that. We run tests on about 3,000 applications a day to determine whether or not things that worked on Windows 7 still work on Windows 8. Right? So back in Vista, it was about 1,000 for Windows 7. It was a couple thousand for Windows 8. It was over 3,000 to understand whether or not things are breaking on the new operating system. And some things broke, and we fixed the ones that we can go and buy. Right? Commercial software, we're pretty good at, because we can go to the store too. Enterprise software, that's where we try to share our knowledge. But when we look at what actually happens, the fix that we have when something just needs to believe it's running on a previous operating system is used to fix 255 applications, and we haven't even put it out to the public yet. Right? And we will do more. So the approach that we are using for AppCompat in the product itself, we have telemetry going on within the product. We now measure whether or not someone has shimmed you. We measure how often you're being run, so we can look at anyone who's enabled the customer experience improvement program. We can analyze that data and see the stuff that's being broken, and that feeds directly into the Windows updates that deliver updates to this system shim database to add more. Right now, we're really just, you know, MSDN distribution, TechNet distribution, and I think volume licensing distribution, and that's it. And so far, we already have 255. So, you know, we at one point computed that there were about 17% of common applications that were doing that. Yes, sir?
Do you fix your own internal applications based on that?
Do we fix our internal applications? Yeah, Zune? These are actually really old versions of Zune, if you look at it. We have Office in there, too. It's really awesome. But this is 4.7, right? So older ones had this problem. That one, Zune and, like, Adobe Reader and things like that where it's free are pretty easy to resolve. But we do want to get them to run. I remember another example was in AOL, right? Because in the U.S., people sometimes still use AOL, which is remarkable that you would use a modem in this day and age, but some people do. The goal that we had from a compatibility standpoint was to get you to the point where the updater ran. We didn't care if everything else was horrible, and if it looked bad, we didn't care. We just wanted to get to the updater. This is working directly with them. I went on site with them. They're in their offices in Ruston, Virginia, and we just, one by one, right, because AOL 9 is actually about 15 different things, all called 9 because they're good at numbers, to resolve that. So, yes, we absolutely reach out to the internal teams and make sure that they understand, can you please stop doing that? And to set an example ourselves, it's a struggle because there are a lot of teams and a lot of developers and a lot of moving parts. It's remarkable to me that this is still as big of a problem as it is, given all that we've done to say, please stop doing it. So thinking about Windows apps, right? We already pointed out one thing you can do to resolve issues with Windows apps. Get a new one and don't write the bug again. Right? That's quite convenient if you have a bottomless pocketbook and an unlimited budget for buying new stuff. Most people are a little bit more constrained than that. They're looking to bleed as much life as they possibly can out of their applications. So the technology that we've built in to allow you to fix things is called shims. How many of you are familiar with what shims are? How many of you are familiar with the intricacies of how shims work and why they work? So a little maybe hand. Let me explain it so that we're all starting off on the same page. Here's what a shim does, right? So in Windows, what we're changing, right, if you think about what Windows is from the perspective of an app, right, we think of Windows as Explorer, solitaire, the important stuff. But what an app thinks of about Windows is it's a bunch of DLLs that do some work for me. DLLs that I enter into using defined Windows APIs, ideally, sometimes using undocumented Windows APIs, but ideally using documented Windows APIs. Now, the way that DLLs work is that a DLL has an ideal starting point in memory. And it'll say that. I would like to start here. But sometimes someone else is already there, which means it has to move. It's called rebasing. In order to support rebasing, not making your program break, we put in a layer of indirection so that when you say, I would like to, you know, rebase and go somewhere else, right? So let's say I'm for get version EX, we have this table. It's called the import table. The tool we're looking at now is a tool called PE Browse Professional. I like it because it's free and I have no budget. It lets me see the internal workings of what's going on inside of a Windows portable executable file format, an .exe or a DLL, and I can see all of the headers, right? The code is in here too. It's under the text section, right? Here's where the actual code is that does the work. But the layer of indirection that makes DLLs work is called the import table. I have a list of all the DLLs I'm going to use, in this case, kernel 32. Then I have the functions I'm going to use and the offset within that DLL that I would need to call in order to start running that function. When we load it in and it gets an actual base address, we take the base address, we add the offset, and boom, there's the address to call. So you can just do a JMP or a call, give it that indirect address from the table, and boom, you jump over to the DLL. Nice. Little table, guess what we do for shims? Go to the address that would be pointing to the get version or whatever other function we're shimming, and just give it the address of another function that lives inside of a shim DLL that makes it behave differently. For example, in the version lie, we just replace get version EXW, and instead of returning 6.2.9200, sorry, I don't actually have that memorized yet. Instead of returning that, we'll return whatever you asked us, 6.1.7000 or 6.0.whatever Vista was, or 5.1.2600 or 2800 or whatever it is that we put in there and just give that instead. Just lie. That's what shims do. So the shims themselves are fully supported code that comes with Windows. Right? The question then comes up, well, you know, fully supported, help me navigate the support thing. Right? If I shim it, is it supported? And the reality is, if you're shimming it, that's usually because it's already unsupported. You'd like to use it longer anyway and not buy a new one. It doesn't become more supported because you've shimmed it. It's already unsupported, or you just call them. Right? So all we're doing is allowing you to get more life from your applications. What most people do is decide what are the circumstances in which it's okay for me to shim. And they come up with a list of them. One is, I have a vendor who made the app, a real common scenario. I hired someone, they came in, they built the app, they went away, and I've never seen them again. Right? They didn't give me the source code, they built me an app and they left. They were a hired gun, they were a consultancy that came in, built it, and left. So I need to get some more life out of this one because I don't know where that guy is. So I got nothing to do to get it fixed. Another situation, right? I've got a number of applications that are broken. My internal development teams are overloaded. I don't want to have to wait for them to give me new versions. If the shims are sufficiently low risk, I'll go ahead and take the shimmed versions so I can separate my dependency on those applications getting a full ship cycle and still deploy in time because time is starting to kind of run out. When we think about, well, you said risk and what's not risk, what shims do is a little bit different, right? Whether there's risk or not risk. One of the real common ones I use is because of a lot of dependency on admin rights. right? And we've actually gotten around a lot of that. Some things in box, some things we can fix with shims. One of the things we do to get past shims is, you know, get past it, though, also entails us to have the application believe that it's an admin. Why? Because someone filed a bug at some point saying, this doesn't run correctly for my non-admin users. What's the most common fix for that in the XP era? To check to see if you're an admin and put up a warning dialog and then exit if you're not an admin user. That's a great fix. That was our Visual Studio 2005 fix, by the way. That was fantastic. So we have a shim called isUserAnAdmin. Right, I'll go through this and explain because it kind of goes into a couple of things. What are the kind of things that we're doing in shims? As well as, what's the possible performance impact of shims? That was a question that just came up today from our chief architect from the Americas. Tell me about the performance impact of shims. So what we'll do is do what I guess you'd normally do at about this time on a Thursday and reverse engineer assembly language, right? This is a 400 level class, right? So 500 level, you got to write your own assembly language. This is only 400, so we're just going to read it. Whoa, that zoomed in awfully close. That is not what I meant to do. There. Oh, no, too close. There we go. So, wow, that is not zoomed well at all. Let's try again. All right. Let's take a look at what this does. This is a whole function right here. It's actually okay if you don't understand the assembly language. I would actually be a little disturbed if you did. Most people haven't done it since college. What we're doing is we're going through and we're putting out some debug output. So the first two-thirds of it is just saying, I did something as a shim. The actual work that gets done begins right here. Here's what the isUserAnAdmin API is done when shimmed with the forceAdminAccess shim. ForceAdminAccess sounds like we're actually forcing you to have admin rights, which is not true at all. Here's what it does for real. Is the user an admin? First, we do an XOR for EAX against EAX. Exclusive OR means you have to be different in the two values. If the two values are the same because they're both EAX, they are by definition not different. This just happens to be the fastest way on an Intel processor to set a register to zero. It is faster than just setting it at zero to do an XOR. So we're setting it to zero. Then we're incrementing it, meaning we're setting it to 1. 1 is also equal to true, and then we're returning. So literally, this is the full C++ Windows source code for the isUserAnAdmin shim. That's it. Is the user an admin? Yes. All right, carry on then. And then we go in through and do that. So if we think about the performance characteristics, the actual isUserAnAdmin has to do the work to find out. This one just says, I don't care. Yes, you are. It's like in Ghostbusters. If someone asks if you are a god, you say yes. And that's how shims work. And it's a super powerful technique. And I want to go through and do some work. I'm going to start off with an application that used to be part of the AppCompat toolkit in 6.0. Someone left the XML out of the build process for the Windows ADK until we got to the point where we had to have a recall class bug to put it in there, which means it's no longer there. But it is still available on my blog for download. It's called Stock Viewer, and you can do it with a web search for Stock Viewer Shim Demo. And it gives you that problem of checking for an admin. The way to fix that is to just tell it, yes, I am an admin. So I will use this tool that I was using before, which I didn't introduce. I'll introduce it briefly now, called the Compatibility Administrator. It's part of the AppCompat toolkit. This is the one from version 6. To fix an application, you just add a new fix. I'll call this Stock Viewer. It's by me. It's in Program Files. Stock Viewer, and it's stockviewer.exe. And I just want to do the WinXP because it really wants to be running on XP. Let's assume we're on XP3. Save it. I'll call this teched. Drop it on my desktop. and install this database. Locally, it's relatively easy. It's a right click. Across an organization, it's a single line of scripting code to sdbinst.exe, which is in System 32 and therefore in the path on nearly every configuration of Windows I've ever seen. Sdbinst, point at the SDB, will make a copy of it into the Windows/@patch directory and then flip some registry bits to make create process aware of its existence. With this in place, now when I go to launch Stock Viewer, I'll have the force admin access shim running. Oh, that worked really well. Fascinating. So let's, you know what I say, I can never have a failed demo. I can only have unintended debugging demos. So let me make sure, so 1.0.0.1, and this should be pointing to open file location. That's fantastic. This is going great so far. Maybe it wants XE think. It's 1.0.0.1, so it's got a match on it. My goodness, I did. That was actually part of the test. What's interesting is that the version lib won't actually matter, so it actually gives us an interesting thing to talk about. I'm so used to version lib because I do it all the time now. Let's just edit that. Force admin access, try this again, save, install. And now if we go to launch it, that problem goes away. Great! It only took 2 tries for me to get the demo I wrote to work. Go me! But, you know, again, it's one of those things you can always get it done and being careful. So when it comes to this, what I actually do is I keep a OneNote notebook every time I'm going on site and I write everything down because I make mistakes all the freaking time. But I take good notes, so I can step backwards a lot more easily by saying, all right, well, where did I start, and then where did I go awry? The interesting thing about my having put in the version lib shim is that I happen to configure compat admin, my shortcut for it, to use the super secret undocumented /x command line switch, which tells me which things are being excluded, because here's the thing about shims. Shims will apply to the XE and to every statically linked DLL, as well as to all dynamically loaded DLLs by, in essence, shimming the... My goodness, that's loud. By shimming the load library and get proc address APIs as well to intercept those as well and ensure that they all get done. We exclude, by default, anything in System 32. We're assuming that Windows itself ought to be compatible with Windows, we hope. And we also give a shim the ability to exclude its own things, and the version lie happens to exclude the .NET runtime, because it turns out if we tell the .NET runtime that you're running some older version of Windows, it behaves differently in ways that are sometimes extremely suboptimal. I really wish someone would figure out how to tell the people next door to go a little bit more quiet. That was a hint for anyone who's on the crew who can assist me with this. So the version lib actually didn't do anything to help me. The force admin access did help me. And that's how I go about fixing applications. That's an easy one. That's a sample application. That's not the real world. So let's look at the messy nature of the real world for troubleshooting applications. This is commercially available software, SQL Nav 5. And here was the problem we were troubleshooting. I just double-clicked it, and nothing happened. Good, that's going great. So let's figure out why it's not working. So one of the first places I like to start when figuring out why something is not working is to go to Process Monitor. And we'll go ahead and launch the application, go back to procmon, It is now furiously writing things onto the screen. So let's go ahead and stop monitoring and apply a filter and take a look at the process name where it equals sqlnav5.exe to filter that down to something manageable and see that we got 655 events. And if we scroll down towards the bottom, we'll see that the process exited with an exit status of 0, which means everything is fine. Good job. But if we go up before it a little bit, we'll notice that shortly before it starts tearing itself down, it hits access denied, trying to write this toad-debug.txt file in the root of C. Aha! That's the problem. You're writing this to the place where you're not allowed to write, and that's a problem, so that's something I can fix. Right? I can fix that by redirecting it. There's a shim called correct file paths, and correct file paths will allow me to intercept every call to create file or the other file APIs and modify the arguments. So let's go ahead and try to fix that. So we'll go back into compat admin. We'll see if we can do it correctly this time. This is for sqlnav. This is by unnamed company, because none of you have web browsers and can look them up. Program files, and I dropped it right here, sqlnav 5. And I'm going to apply correct file paths. And correct file paths is one of those shims that requires me to configure it, to tell it where things ought to go. And I have to do that via the parameters. So what I want to do is I want to redirect it from this one, and I'm going to very intentionally copy and paste it from this location to user app data toad-debug.txt. I wish we had more noise going on. That would really make it much more exciting in here. So here's how I'm going to configure it. So let's go ahead and save this and install it. And I thought, all right, yep, another easy job to get shimmed up. So we'll go ahead and try it again now. And, oh, that didn't work out so well, right? So then you start doing what I was doing last time, which is, all right, what did I do wrong? And when you finally figure out, I actually don't think I've done anything wrong, which I usually assume it's my mistake first, the next question is, well, what did go wrong? There are one of two things which make shims appear not to work correctly, right, when it comes to correct file paths. Thing number one is that the source of the call to open the file is sitting in system32, which we exclude by default, and we need to include. So I would test that by putting an include star, which puts everything in there, and see if that works. And if I do that, I'll find that that still doesn't help, right? Because where that comes in, a lot of times, is VB6 apps all bounce through msvbvm60.dll sitting inside of system32. And MSXML will also push some things through MSXML sitting in system32. So I tried that, and that didn't work. So the other thing is I don't have an exact match. Because here's the thing with correct file paths. It's intercepting file APIs. Have you ever sat and watched Procmon for a while? File APIs are called a lot. So we do as little work as we possibly can. We do a very fast string compare and get out. If you are not an exact match, we don't change you. So my suspicion was, perhaps we don't have an exact match. So let's go ahead and launch it in a debugger so we can inspect the arguments. Expensit, sqlnav 5. And I'm going to set a breakpoint on the API that was being called. And I'm showing you in a debugger right now, because this is how I did it. And I'm doing this not to teach you how to use a debugger, because I'm next going to show you the much better way to solve it. It's a lesson that I keep teaching myself. Don't go deep first. Your best troubleshooting tool is your brain. Think about the problem and find the easiest way to solve something. I once did a session on app compat debugging without a debugger, where with every single one I asked smart questions. I did it for an internal Microsoft audience and got totally slammed because of the lack of a debugger, even though if you actually did it that way, you would save a ton of time, right? I went right to a debugger, which, as we'll see a little bit later on, was a pretty silly thing to do. With the debugger, I knew that it was calling through, and I could look at the stacks. SQL nav 5 went into kernel base, and of course, symbols are not loaded. The actual call, other than waiting for them to load, is in kernel 32, create file A. It was convenient that it was the create file A as opposed to create file W. Create file A is for ASCII characters, create file W is for Unicode characters, create file W is what nearly everything uses. So having it be A differentiates it from the process loading stuff, makes it much easier to get a debug breakpoint. And I went, I hit the debug breakpoint, and then if I have private symbols for Windows, real easy to look at the arguments. But I was at a customer site and didn't have that. I was on their computer, so I had to just go and inspect the argument so I can go and through a dump the ASCII, and you know the stack pointer plus 4 happens to contain it, and look at the argument that was passed. I put a blog post, incidentally, that shows how to go through and compute this if you ever want to figure out how to get the arguments and reverse it from the APIs. My purpose is not to teach you how to debug today, but to show you what the problem was. Here's the problem. It was not asking for C:\toaddebug.txt. It was asking for /toaddebug.txt, which is not a literal match, so we skipped right past it. So in order to get this working, I would have to modify that argument, go back into SQL nav, right click, edit application fix, next, show me the selected ones, get the parameters, and just replace that with /toaddebug.txt. Now it will be a literal match, right click, your button is not working so well today, right click install. And now when I go to launch the application, it launches. And you can kind of see that's the sort of thing that you're like, wow, I'm not going to do that. Right? And so I took someone else who had this problem, and they were rather inconveniently for me, a guy who lives in Chicago. I mean, I travel a lot, but I can't get everywhere. They were in Jordan. And I can't remember where I was, but it was one where I was in nowhere near the same time zone. So you're thinking, how do I, as efficiently as possible, go through the debugging steps with someone who doesn't really know app compat? So you've got to think. That's where you really put your skills to test. Think about how you can help to get them to the answer as quickly as possible. And I had an idea that was way better than explaining to them how to go through and do the debugging process. There is a free tool made by my friend Aaron called Lua Buglight. Lua Buglight will capture details of things that are causing standard user problems. This is an access denied, so it qualifies. I said, can you please capture the output from the application and send that to me, right? So step one. And then she sent the report over to me. Grab it off the desktop. And I can inspect it, and I could go in and see, here is the details of what it was doing. So I can see the writes to C that were being corrected. The thing that Lua Buglight does that's super interesting is it includes its actual parameter. So we can see what was passed to the API, not the parameter as would be seen by process monitor, which is running at the kernel level after things have already been normalized. So if I start scrolling through the events, I noticed the problem. Ah. Process monitor was saying it was C:\, but the actual parameter provided was typographically incorrect. C:\, which we corrected. And that's why the correction wasn't working, because it wasn't a literal string match. Fix it up to actually have the backslash. Bang, the application starts working again. So now, if it's a standard user problem, I almost always start with this tool, which simply entails me running the application and looking at the output instead of grokking around and setting breakpoints in a debugger. Lesson learned, don't spend too much time in a debugger. Think about the problem first. The most important thing to chase is a hypothesis that you're trying to prove or disprove. So that's a little bit about shims. What I want to do now, I guess I'm going to get into a debugger again because I'm apparently awesome that way. To show you the one technique with a debugger that actually might help you to understand what's going on. It's a single command. It's the only thing you ever need to know. If I do a, and you can use WinDBG if you like Windows apps, is to go ahead and pull open a dump file, which I took from an application that was crashing to try and figure out what the problem with the dump file was, and take a look at what's going on. It's bang, or exclamation point, analyze, /V, to tell you what the problem was. Here's the problem. This is Internet Explorer crashing a lot. And they were trying to figure out why is Internet Explorer crashing a lot. I took the dump file, and I ran bang analyze against it to try to figure out why it was crashing so much. Oh, really? You're going to go through and look at all the symbols? There we go. And I found this. Right on their Windows 7 image, right? And for anyone who doesn't know, LMVM, MS Java, let's see what that is. That is the Microsoft Java Virtual Machine, which we stopped making and stopped supporting circa 2001 when we got sued to oblivion by Sun for having done things with it that they didn't like for us to do, and we were obligated to not support it, not help, and then we got some kind of agreement that let us, you know, support it in the products that actually had ongoing support until we could work you out of it, and it was a whole big thing, and every time we see this showing up in call stacks, we're like, yeah, we really can't help you with that. Stop using MS Java, right? And I've had other customers who were actually intentionally using it, and it was a problem. And this is one category of things that can be hard to solve. If you're using MS Java, you really need to stop, right? But there's other problems with Java as well. When we think about the challenges that face your security, there is nothing more dire in terms of actual measured exploits on the internet than Java exploits. It's the number one source that people are actually using to attack things. So we're not talking about who wrote the worst software, blah, blah, blah. We're talking about what are the bad guys using? Why are the bad guys using it? Because guess what? Every enterprise in the world that I've talked to, probably every, I don't know that I've ever found one that doesn't, will go through and pick their version of Java. One of my favorite conversations ever. We're updating from 1.3 and we're standing on Java 1, standardizing on Java 1.5 update 5. This was about 4 months ago. I pointed out that version 1.5 went end of life at that time over a year earlier at update 22. So they were 17 versions out of date on an unsupported platform as their new standard. So why do bad guys go after Java? Because enterprises keep running old vulnerable versions. The problem is the new versions are where the security patches come in. You can't stay on old versions and get your security patches. You have to update. And what's the biggest problem with the apps that don't work when you update? I'll give you a hint. It's the same thing that we saw at the beginning for Windows. They're asking, hey, what version of Java are you? Oh, I don't know you. I'll go ahead and not run then. Unfortunately, they don't have a version line. So we've got to figure out that strategy. The other Java thing to be aware of, how many of you have JInitiator still running? Yeah, Oracle won't support you on Windows 7. They said, you know what, just buy our new stuff. And they're not going to ever make one that works. And I have tried to fix it. I cannot get it working in every scenario. I've gotten it working in some, and then it fails in others. Right? So it's one of those things where there's a limit to what we can do to put duct tape on it. So it's another one to move forward. The other question that comes up is, what about Visual Basic? What's Visual Basic going to do for Windows 8? Right? If we look up Visual Basic 6, Windows 8, I can find the support statement, navigate to it. And we have already announced that Visual Basic 6 will be fully supported on Windows 8 for the duration of Windows 8. So it's going to be fully supported until 2022. Think about that. 2022. We introduced it in 1998. By the time it goes end of life, it will have lived for at least 24 years, assuming we don't add it to Windows 9 also. 24 years. That's longer than Buddy Holly was alive. There are some details that are worth knowing. These are the binaries that ship as part of the OS. There are some that are supported that you have to include yourself. So most of these are ActiveX controls. So if you're using them, we'll support them. If they're broken, we'll fix them. If there's a security vulnerability, we'll address it. But you have to put it in your installer, because they're not on the OS by default. And you'll have to register them and register them elevated so they actually get registered. Don't just call Red Server 32 in a script and hope for the best at runtime, because that won't work out so well. And we also have a final category of unsupported. And unsupported is not like, you know what, we didn't feel like it or we don't like those. Unsupported means we didn't write these. We licensed them. Right, so for example, the Threed DLL, Threed 32, Threed 16, we licensed that from someone else. That someone else was bought out by another company in 1998. That other company went out of business in 1999. We don't know where they are. We don't know where their code is. So if you have a problem, it's not that we don't want to fix it. It's that we don't have the code. So we can't fix it. So therefore, we can't support it. Mostly these are ActiveX controls as well. ActiveX had a lot of success with getting them running, but that's the only thing to call out in terms of, you know, what you need to do to prepare is make sure that you distribute the stuff you need if you don't already have it on there, and be aware that some of them don't have support, though they may very well work. We don't know or make any claims around that. But VB6 will still be okay. That being said, it does make sense to start thinking about what your plan is, because it's harder and harder to maintain that code. If you have a problem with your .NET code and you call our support lines, we'll help you figure out what's going on. If you have a problem with VB6 code, more and more you've got to prove first and foremost it's not your code that's the problem, because we don't support your code, that it's actually the runtime, and that can be a relatively difficult barrier to get past. So thinking about how do I gradually retire it is the path to go down. You can't replace everything, but building up the muscles to learn how to gradually retire things is something that we as an industry could certainly stand to get better at. So let's turn the corner a little bit now and talk a little bit about the browser. I love this site because it tells me how much VB6 there still is. China is still a little bit scary. They're at 21.3, so literally more than one out of five people who browses the web in China is still using IE6. But Australia is at 0.8%. So good job. And mostly, that's businesses. Right? That's the big problem that we face, is it's all of our business customers. So when I think about it, I'm not going to dwell on this too long, but one of the things, like a couple of points I always make when having conversations about the browser, right? One of them is we've made you an incredibly configurable browser. So configurable, in fact, that the number of possible permutations of IE group policies, all 1,500 of them, is actually greater than the number of molecules in the observable universe. So going through one by one generally turns out to be a colossally ill-thought-out idea. Sticking with proven solutions and default configurations or known configurations is almost always a better bet. I also, step one is figure out when you're going to do that. The other is to build allies for the transition you're making, right? To help make people want it so they're pulling, right? Well, the biggest problem with Vista wasn't that they couldn't get it done, because lots of people did. It was that the people didn't want it. So they tried to put in roadblocks to prevent it from getting done so they could keep what they actually liked. Spending some time to help convince people that they like it is usually a good investment of your time. Let's talk with one audience, the audience that probably is least invested in loving IE, and that's the developer. There's actually some really cool stuff for developers in IE. This is IE 10, but we've had this since IE 8. It got better in IE 9 and better still in IE 10, the dev tools. If you're a developer, you're probably starting to get used to seeing stuff like this. This is the script that's been super compressed by Google directly from the Google homepage. This is fantastic if you are paying the bandwidth bills. If you are a developer, have you ever tried debugging that? That's not so fun. Until I go in and use the format JavaScript function in the developer tools, and boom, there's my script for debugging, and that's something I can get my head around. Finding some way to internally market it to the audiences that care about it turns out to be really important. Before we dive into doing some real troubleshooting, I've got some live websites. I'm hoping they're still broken. They were when I tested everything earlier today, but they are live internet sites. The most important thing to understand about IE is that IE is not one thing. There is not one IE way to render and lay out a web page or run scripts. We keep, in fact, adding more. And I can see the more ways to do it when I look at the document mode. These are the different rendering engines that you get to choose from for IE. Here, what we had in IE 6, which is when we started doing this, was 6 standards, or at the time we just called it standards, and quirks, which was equivalent to IE 5.5. The developer would choose by putting a doc type in there if they wanted standards. They didn't put it in there, then we would assume that they still wanted quirks, that it was legacy, because, of course, what developer wouldn't be putting a doc type in there? Turns out that all the developers that I've talked to over the course of the past 6-plus years I've spent doing AppCompat, the number that have been familiar with what doc types are has so far to date been 2. So it turns out a lot of developers wouldn't do it. If their tool sticks it in, they'll have one. If it doesn't, they won't. And no one thinks about what it means. When we went to IE7, we kept quirks mode since it was the default, and we added updates to the standards compliance and called it 7 standards and got rid of the old 6 standards mode. So it's gone. Fortunately, there's not a lot of breaking changes between the two. There are other problems that affect IE6 to IE7 or later transitions that we'll discuss as we go along. When we went to IE8, major investment in established standards, massively breaking. So we kept 7 standards as a legacy implementation of standards and added 8 standards. And kept, of course, quirks, because that's the default. When we went to IE9, we kept the 3 we had already, and we added 9 standards. And with IE10, we figured adding one at a time wasn't quite enough. We made 2 more. A new interoperable quirks mode, which we'll see what that results in as we get through some demos later, as well as a new standards mode for IE10. So now there are literally 6 different ways you can lay out a page. And you've got to choose the right one. And developers don't know they're on the hook to choose it. So the more we can spread this message and build these standards, the less work we have to do in transitioning. And the fact of the matter is, it's not just how's the page going to look and is it going to be more compatible. I also need to think about my long-term plans for this, right? How am I going to build a standard strategy? Because it's entirely possible for me to build an entire web application estate using nothing but quirks mode by simply not putting a doc type in anything. What's the harm in that? Well, there's a couple. Harm number one, quirks mode is a 1999 implementation of standards. How many college kids today are coming out of university ready for their jobs, having done nothing but program with IE 5.5? How many have used IE since they left home and went to college? Approximately equal to that number. Problem number two, our major investments in performance are in our more current engines. So here's the SunSpider test. This is a test that's put together by the WebKit folks, so it's at webkit.org. It's made by the folks who make the engine that runs Chrome as well as Safari. It's unbiased, so whenever people say IE10 is not as fast as Chrome, I just run Chrome's own test and beat them. I love doing that. And notice that I get this great score of 284.4 milliseconds. I could run it on Chrome. It takes a while to run. If you want me to do it, I will in the background. But that's on IE10 standards. If I run the exact same test on Quirks, look what happens. 572.8. It's about half as fast. And that's actually better than it used to be. You know what it was in IE9? It was 10 times slower. Now, it wasn't slower than Quirks mode was on 8 or 7 or 6 or 5, but it was way slower than standards mode could be. So if you want heavy JavaScript performance, right, where I first ran this test was in response to someone coming in, right, and people always think they got me. This is one of the weird things, by the way, about working at Microsoft, is that everyone wants to find some way to get you for some reason, right? You say, oh, where do you work? I work at Microsoft. Oh, I love Apple so much. Like, oh, where do you work? American Airlines? Gosh, I love United. They're great. Oh, Qantas? Oh, yeah, I really like what Virgin's doing lately. I mean, what a strange way to behave. But he comes in saying, hey, you say you're faster. Look how much faster Chrome is. And then I looked and saw that he was running it in Quirks mode. Since it lays out correctly in Chrome, I knew it was therefore highly likely that it would work in standards mode. So using DevTools, I just promoted it. Boom, put it in standards mode, and we were way faster than Chrome. He was like, oh, I didn't know that. The great unknown. So challenge number one, let's leverage this to get things working. Challenge number two is going to be what happens next. Once we get over the big hump and we, I'm not supposed to say kill anymore, retire all of the XP, then we need to look at our portfolio and see, could we benefit from investing and updating the standards? Because today, the average number of websites in the enterprise using Quirks mode is 70%. In the top 5,000 web applications that we measure for public facing, for IE, 12% are using Quirks mode. More than 1 in 10 public facing, where multiple browsers is a very hard reality running in Quirks, and 7 out of 10 in the enterprise, which is more understandable because you have much more control of the browser. So that's what we want to try and think about the long-term solution for. Oh, I already got that one. So let's go in and talk about some of the issues to anticipate. Right? I recently went on a trip, this was maybe a couple months ago, to Rome, which is awesome, by the way. And we just went app by app, and right, everyone always thinks that if they have a large enough pile of applications, they'll keep me busy. And one, what we found for them, they were going from IE8 to IE9, and they were sure that it was hard, right? And I usually think this tends to be pretty easy. The problem they had was old jQueries. So this is the next thing we need to start socializing is jQuery is middleware that needs to be updated. You can't just grab one at some arbitrary point in time and expect it to live forever on every new browser as it comes out. They're constantly updating that stuff. And here's the other thing. The new stuff is remarkably compatible with your old apps. It really doesn't break stuff that I've seen so far. So we just went app by app and said, all right, here's your jQuery 1.3. Here's a 1.1. Here's a 1.4. Let's just keep updating them to the latest version and blowing through the apps that way. So the first thing, mind your middleware. Be aware of what it's depending on so you can go through and troubleshoot it. What's the next problem? Versions. Wow, what a surprise. Yet again, versions are a problem. This one was just sent to me yesterday where someone said, hey, this is kind of weird. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that is kind of weird. It's calling me an IE6 user. How dare they? And then you look, try to figure out, what's it doing? It's like, oh, they do put in their slightly grayed. Please remember to honor your IT department's policies before installing new software. Subtly, just in case. Because it is, after all, SAP, which wouldn't be used by anyone other than someone who has an IT department. Because who buys it for their house? You know, we got a lot of stuff. It's time to start managing it in SAP, honey. Right, and here's what's remarkable about it to me. I can fix this. I don't even need to change how it's laid out. I can just say, you know what? Let's tell it I'm IE9. And actually navigate to the page. Once I'm telling it I'm IE9, I'll wait for the network. And then it'll just pop up. And it actually works in IE9 mode, in IE8 mode, in IE7 mode. They're not doing anything really sophisticated with their HTML. It works in each of those different modes. All they've done is on the server, to see if you are using IE6, they're asking, are you IE7? Are you IE8? Are you IE9? Again, they're missing that one key that makes that kind of brackety-looking thing that would have solved that problem for everything we ever make. And it's on the server, so we're kind of screwed. There's nothing much we can do with it. And the thing was, since it works in 7 or 8 or 9, he was like, I just want to put it in compat mode and fix that problem. Except there's no button there. He's like, then, so his next question, this was all going on over Twitter. This is a guy, he's somewhere in South America, I forget which country, but he occasionally just sends me his gnarliest bugs. This one was actually pretty easy. One of them stumped me for like 3 or 4 weeks. It turned out to be the worst anti-debugging software I've ever seen that was interfering with random jump tables, and it was really, really super gnarly. And so I said, stop tweeting me, please, because your problems are too hard. So he sent me this one. And he's like, there's no compat view button. Why is there not a compat view button? The reason why there would not be a compat view button is if someone's already told us what rendering mode they want. In which case, we don't need to put the button on because we already know what you want. I can use the network tools and the dev tools to figure out, did they say anything? I can look at the HTML, but there is no meta tag, which means that therefore, if there's no button, they must have put something in the response header, and indeed, there it is. XUA compatible is the header to put on, right? So if you are trying to get an app on one of your servers to run in a previous mode, you just add this header. It's relatively easy to do. XUA compatible, IE equals edge. So they've actually requested something, and here's the funny thing. They are claiming that they will run on any version of IE and any new rendering engine that we make between now and the end of time, while simultaneously not even working on the very next one we put out. And that's why there's no compat view button. So it's a site bug. Right now I've got a problem. I would have to put in group policy to target SAP.com, to put it into compat view button, not because it needs the rendering engine, but because it needs the version lie until they go through and do the update. I'll probably blog this one, which will hopefully get it fixed. I found there's actually a fairly high correlation between when I blog it and when things start getting fixed because it starts getting some attention, but I didn't want to do that before here because great demo, isn't it? Right, so all about user agent strings, and you can see the user agent string, and this is a web page, enhanceie.com/UA, which is by Eric Lawrence, who will be with us for the rest of the month, but then is going to Telerik, which is a real big loss for us, because he's a super smart guy. I can go through and see the user agent string change, so we just lie as we put in these different modes. I can say, oh, pretend to be in compat view, pretend to be IE7. Oh, that's really going well. awesome. You're doing great, browser. It'll change the user agent string. Other problems. So this is a website that I debugged for a friend of mine. I actually showed this one last year, and I'm bringing it back here, and it's going to be different. This is a website that it runs, what's it called? Centricity Enterprise Web. Basically, it lets a doctor look at radiology data online. It's a web application, right? So I have a buddy of mine. He's the director of functional and stereotactic surgery at Northwestern University in Chicago in the U.S. So we have a great deal going on. Every time I need my brain operated on, he's in charge of that. Every time his computer's broken, I'm in charge of that. So far, he's gotten the much better deal out of that. And I'm not sure that I feel terrible about that. But if I look at this, let's start up Fiddler. Because I want to grab good news. It's very happy. Next time. Let's not do it right now. What I want to do is refresh and pull out the HTML just so I can show you exactly what they're doing. So there's a checks.js, and I'm going to, using the Fiddler tool, soon to be a Telerik Fiddler, and save out the response body so we can inspect it. I'll just drop it on my desktop and take a look at what they've done, because I debugged it live on stage here last year, right? It's one of those things where it turns out if you debug something on Channel 9, people notice it and start fixing their apps because they kind of got called on the carpet. So I figured they'd fix it, and sure enough, it works in IE9, but then I go to IE10 and it doesn't work again. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of inconvenient. I wonder why it's not working now. So if I just look for, wow, really? What is the text again? Not sufficient. Ah, not insufficient. Not sufficient. Right, so here's the text and here's the check. So this was the check that we called out last time. Here's how they're determining if your scripting engine is sufficient or not. They're looking at the script engine major version, the script engine minor version, right? And what's wrong with this logic? This actually works great through IE8. IE9, the script engine, all new, Chakra script engine, is version 9.0. Is 9 less than 5? No, test passes. Is 0 less than 5? Yes, test fails. Right? But I just told you it's now working on IE9, so it must be one of these things prior to this else. Let's take a look at their fix. I love this. This is such a good fix. Okay, first of all, I wrote the fix and it's recorded on the web. They could have typed in my code and never told me and I would have never noticed it. But here's what they did instead. They're going to make string script engine version and they're going to take major version and put a period and then put in the minor version. Make it into a string. So there's a bit of a perf impact because now you're boxing things and converting it and spending a lot of time in the script engine doing things. The other part of the perf impact is that that then is completely ignored and never used. We then go through and check the major version, compare it for equality with 9.0. So it's major version, it's 9, there is no 0.0, but fortunately because of various boxing and conversions, we consider 9.0 to be the equivalent of 9. We just have to do a conversion first and a few hundred machine assembly language instructions to make that happen for no good reason. But it turns out this passes for 9 and starts failing for 10 where the script engine version is 10.0. And of course, the minor version will never be 9.0 because it's O. So that's not so useful, but it's an OR. So we pass and we say it's okay. And they've now fixed it for one more version instead of just writing the logical check the right way. Versions are a problem because people really suck at writing version checks. Right? And it's not just us, right? One of the conversations I get into all the time is, hey, we're just going to skip this whole IE compat thing and we're just going to use Chrome Frame and that makes the problem go away. Right? There's a couple of challenges with that. If you think moving browsers once every 10 years is too much work, suggesting a solution of doing it literally 100 times as often may not be the smartest idea. Problem number two, Chrome frame. Turns out the people who check for Chrome are the same people who suck at doing version checks for everything else. I want to check and see if you're Chrome to give you some HTML5. I get some IE user agent string that has Chrome frame installed. It'll include the word Chrome frame on there. Guess what a substring of Chrome frame is? Chrome. So they find the word Chrome and they give it some HTML5. Unfortunately, they don't give it an XUA compatible asking for Chrome frame, and therefore they're feeding your old version of IE6 some brand spanking new HTML5 that your old browser spits up on. So there are problems everywhere with trying to find the one silver bullet that requires you to learn how to correctly use a greater than key. So with that, oh, I got to do this one. This is a rehash. Well, actually, no. I'll skip on to this one. This is a rehash of one that's going to point out why we have the new interoperable quirks mode. This is a website that on IE9 didn't look right. And if I re-render it using the old IE5 quirks, you'll see that I lose some of the text. It kind of gets buried up here. The submission form is a real mess. Unfortunately, the event ended about a year ago, so I can't submit right now and show you that form, but I can still see some of the things that are wrong with it. That's because the doc type it uses is one that gives you quirks mode, as defined by this incredibly complex table. But by building interoperable quirks, we now render this page exactly the same way as the browser they actually tested this on, Firefox and or Chrome and or everybody else, using a quirks mode that's the same as everybody's, not a quirks mode that is the same as IE5. Therefore, making the web a better place. If you are in a company, your quirks mode is going to be the old IE5 one, so you'll want to know that there are two and ensure that everything is zoned correctly, because the default for local intranet, compat view, 7 standards or 5 quirks. The default for the internet, 10 standards or the new interoperable quirks. You'll get different quirks mode behavior now where you never did in the past. So be aware of that. Remember, as you're troubleshooting, think your way through the problem, have a good hypothesis, and find the fastest way to the answer. With that, happy troubleshooting, happy fixing, and thank you for coming. And now I am actually 2 minutes over, so in the interest of the poor folks who come after me, I'm going to shut her down, and let's see, another brilliant talk. All right. See, I love people that say stuff like that, particularly when they have bad words in their Twitter handle. So I can't share that with anybody. That's awesome. All right. Have a great rest of the conference.